Before we begin, a warning to listeners. This podcast includes accounts of violence against Indigenous peoples.
The Wilderness Act in 1964 defines wilderness as a place where humans are visitors not to remain.
Get rid of all these people so our farmers can have this land to themselves.
Highly questionable because of a whole bunch of anomalies in the story.
The white people are always going to come for the land and the water. They're going to ask you to sell it off. They're going to provide all this money for you, but don't do it.
We have never been given the respect of, oh wow, you say no, that's fine.
We have to do something so we won't have a conscience beating on us. Well, actually, that was probably the most lovely area in the entire Great Basin. There was a great water supply because, well, the mountain in the Great Basin, Mount Wheeler, is the highest mountain in the state, and it gathered all kinds of snowfall, and that was the biggest supply of water for in the Great Basin. And so when people were hunting and gathering, there was a great amount of animals to be hunted. There were medicines, food, fish, all kinds of plant life, berries, nuts.
That's Delaine Spilsbury, a Shoshone Ili elder, retelling the history of a place that's sacred to Indigenous peoples in what we now call Eastern Nevada.
There were so many people that traveled there. Of course, they were on foot, maybe later on on horses. And so they would gather there. And when people gather, they converse and they have meetings and they do this sort of thing. And they celebrate weddings and births just like everybody else did. Because so many of those Indians were together at one time, it was easy to just get rid of them so they wouldn't be on that property that was given to the settlers by the government. So they had three major massacres in the late 1800s. The cavalry went into Spring Valley. It was the 1850s, and they just killed as many people as they possibly could. And that kind of thinned them out a little bit, but then again, in the probably in the 1860s, there was another military, get rid of all these people so our farmers can our people, our ranchers can have this land to themselves. And then again, in the 1890s, but this was not the feds, it was not the cavalry or the army or anybody like that. They were
vigilantes,
I guess is the word I should be using. They attacked the camp. The men had all gone hunting. And so when they attacked the camp, there were elders, mothers, and children. And they just killed everyone that was there. And there were two young girls, they were around 10 at the time, who were off screwing off like I probably would have been too. They were not found, but they did witness the massacre. And one of those girls was my grandmother, Mamie Swallow Joseph. I don't have much more to say about that.
This is Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about the Indigenous peoples of the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. I'm your host, Richard Boland.
You know, the little girls were, when they realized what had happened, they went ahead and walked south, which would be a little bit downhill, I guess, from where they were. And I don't know how far the ranch is. I've always threatened to figure that out, but I haven't. But I'm estimating 25 to 30 miles. And the Swallow family took my grandmother in and named her Mamie Swallow.
In this episode, we're looking at public lands, known by natives as their ancestral or traditional homelands. What happens when the U.S. government grants protection to Indigenous people's sacred sites? Who or what do those sites get protected from? And four. The memories Delaine Spilsbury shared were from an area she and her relatives know as the Shoshone Cedars. Located off Highway 50, around an hour from Ely, the area is defined by a 40-acre grove of Rocky Mountain junipers, which don't normally grow at such a low altitude. Modern researchers refer to the area as the Swamp Cedars due to its high water table. The anomaly birthed a fertile oasis. The area's first people stopped congregating there after the massacres, but relatives still visit today to perform ceremonies and to pay their respects.
It's an absolute memorial because all those people that were killed there, they are still there. Their bodies, I mean, they're not buried there because there was nobody to bury them, but all their remains are in those trees. The trees, that they've become part of the trees. So when we go see them, we talk to the trees.
Listeners of this podcast may remember a reference to this important area in our first episode about the water protectors. The Sacred Run we mentioned raised awareness of a proposal to export water out of the Spring Valley and surrounding region to Las Vegas. The water utility pursuing the pipeline project eventually dropped it, but Delane Spilsbury and other activists weren't satisfied that the Shoshone Cedars were safe from future development. So, Nevada Assemblyman Howard Watts introduced a bill in this year's state legislative session that would make it illegal to cut or damage any of the Rocky Mountain junipers growing in the Shoshone Cedars area.
Thank you very much, again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Howard Watts, for the record, representing Assembly District 15 in Clark County. AB 171 looked to provide protections for a very special, ecologically unique, and culturally significant grove of trees known as the Swamp Cedars in Spring Valley in White Pine County.
Let's go with Senator Hanson.
Thank you. Actually, I support both the bills, just so you know. But there are some problems with some of the things that have been said that kind of concern me. One, Mr. Sanford mentioned that, you know, in America, we don't know anything about the past, but I actually am familiar with the Sand Creek Massacre, Cherokee Trail of Tears, the Seminole Massacres, Wounded Knee. However, the historical stuff around the sites, there's no question that there was a massacre in 1863. However, the 1859 one is highly questionable because of a whole bunch of anomalies in the story. The 1897 one actually is even more questionable because the original accounts indicate that they were cavalry, when there was in fact no cavalry in 1897 in that part of Nevada. The water table argument, there's high water tables all over the place throughout the Rocky Mountains, not just there.
And so tribal representatives like Delane Spilsbury and Goshoot Chairman Rupert Steele joined with environmental nonprofits led by the Great Basin Water Network to back Watts' bill. Today, environmentalists frequently team up with tribes to get U.S. government designations that protect threatened species and ecosystems. Typically, these environmentalists are looking to keep mining companies, oil and gas speculators, and other developers off land that also has cultural significance to the area's indigenous peoples. At the federal level, these protections can take many forms, such as national monuments or wildlife preserves. They're managed by government agencies like the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, and Fish and Wildlife Service. And each designation comes with its own set of rules about what activities can and can't be done in the area. Usually, extractive industry is prohibited, though activities like ranching and OHV riding may be allowed. There's a troubling history behind the system of federal protection for public lands. It has to do with American concepts of ownership, rights, and wilderness.
My name is Mark David Spence. I identify as Métis, which is an Indigenous nation of Canada. I'm the author of a book entitled Dispossessing the Wilderness, Indian Removal and the Making of the National Parks.
Mark's work broke new ground by, among other things, questioning the true meaning of wilderness.
The Wilderness Act in 1964 defines wilderness as a place where humans are visitors not to remain, which in effect erases the concept of indigeneity, ignores that Native peoples had not just been shaping the landscape, but interacting with the landscape, being sort of a co-equal being of the landscape and all its dynamic living and static living parts. So the concept of wilderness itself is, it defines humanity. There's, you know, so if you happen to be a human that has remained in a park that has suddenly become, or a wilderness area that's suddenly defined as wilderness, you're not human. That's sort of the really bonkers part to me of defining wilderness. You know, anyone with a bit of sense knows that Indigenous people now, you know, will now agree that Indigenous people have been on the continent for, at the very least, 25, 30,000 years. And for that entire period, they were people, and they remained the people, first people.
In the early years of contact between European settlers and North American natives, the settlers recognized the natives' relationship to the land. They made treaties to delineate and share cohabitated spaces. But that recognition deteriorated with colonial expansion, as settlers competed with natives for resources. With the early 20th century advent of national parks, Spence notes, came the rise of so-called public lands.
So public lands are celebrated as nobody owns them. We all own them. But the people who sort of apply ownership principles are generally tourists and outdoor recreationalists of various stripes, whether that be people who climb the walls of Yosemite or dine in the Grand Canyon Hotel. The parks are for pleasure. The parks are for sort of nominal education. The parks are where we can see real nature, where we can see the divine, sort of Judeo-Christian conception of divinity, manifested in the landscape, and therefore we can be spiritually, even physically, emotionally uplifted by the experience. And if you go into a park without that attitude, you don't own that park. You don't really belong in that park. So there's almost this, there's a singular code of ethics, which is entirely non-Indigenous, that goes into this sense of, these are my parks, and why are they my parks? Because I understand entirely what they're for.
In order for this abstract idea of non-residential ownership to work, the area's previous residents have got to go.
Eviction. You know, some of these parks came out of Indigenous, you know, American Indian reservations, so a treaty has to occur. That's one way to do it, but the other is just sort of straight up eviction. And few plans ever crafted ever come to full fruition. Native peoples from Grand Canyon, they tried to evict them, but then realized, oh, we need the seasonal labor. Same thing in Death Valley. Certainly the same thing in Yosemite National Park. Glacier, there was sort of a super duper firm boundary, and the Park Service even tried to fence the entire eastern boundary where it abutted the Blackfeet Reservation. So how do you literally you police it? I mean, in many respects, and not even ironically, almost, you know, predictably, what happens is the ecologies of these parks start to go haywire.
Another idea that's central to the American concept of public lands, Spence says, is control.
Public lands also becomes the place where the federal government exercises near entire authority over various landscapes. And quite often those adjoin Native reservations, you know, in the lower 48 and then sort of the reserves that you might find in Alaska as well. And that's the other place where you sort of see American conceptions of ownership, American conceptions of nature, American conceptions of what the purpose of land is. And that is, if it's not a national park, if it's not an Indigenous reserve or reservation or some other bit of public land, it's basically commodity, which is a profound affront to Indigenous sensibilities, which is, it's a very different conception of land.
The American concept of public lands is pervasive. Consider this. The land delineated by Nevada's borders was cultivated, fished, hunted, slept on, sung to, and traversed by various Native peoples long before colonial settlers arrived. The federal government recognized tribal control of vast swaths of that land through treaties with the tribes it created, but then didn't honor the treaties. And tribes never formally ceded their claim to their ancestral homelands. Yet today, it is common knowledge that 80% of the state is, quote-unquote, federally owned. Most people call it public land, not Paiute or Shoshone homeland. When we come back, an approach to protecting public lands that involves the tribes who call it home. You're listening to Native Nevada from KNPR. I'm Richard Boland. This is Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about the indigenous peoples in the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. I'm your host, Richard Boland. Before the break, we heard Mark David Spence describe the complicated relationship that tribes have with U.S. government protection of public lands. Recent developments suggest Americans may be coming full circle, back to seeing Indigenous peoples as intertwined with their lands.
I'm Taylor Patterson. I'm the Executive Director of Native Voters Alliance Nevada. We're a 501c4, so luckily we get to be like a little more politically sassy, if you will. And I'm also a member of the Bishop Paiute Tribe. All the work I do is to uplift Native voices, whether that's urban or rural or whoever really needs the help, as like strange as that may sound, because a lot of our Indigenous folks have been talking about these issues for a very long time and nobody was listening.
Taylor says it's exciting to see a movement recognizing Indigenous people's knowledge of the land and engaging them in public land stewardship, even though it's a little frustrating that it took so long. A recent example of this movement is Gold Butte National Monument. Former President Barack Obama's Gold Butte Proclamation followed 15 years of work on the part of a grassroots group that included the Moapa Band of Paiutes.
I think there's a movement for these projects to go beyond the Gold Butte model, as far as that was really, really good participation and consultation for us, but how can we lead those movements, so to speak? And what I have to like remind people of constantly is even your wealthiest tribal government is super under-resourced and understaffed and doesn't have the time to deal with all of the things that they need to deal with. We need to be having our very base level needs met before we can start taking on these giant projects, because a national monument project takes a long time and it's just almost impossible for a tribal government to do that on their own.
Taylor believes the solution is true allyship, where conservationists or other concerned non-natives let Indigenous people's vision drive the agenda. And then, once the protected area is established, the government and natives co-manage it.
And we have to be so very cautious of the levels of protection we put in these spaces, because what that can do is limit accessibility for tribal members. And so it's wonderful to have a plot of land that's conserved, right? But if nobody can realistically use that land, especially tribal members that have to be in those spaces for cultural enrichment, then what's the point? If our elders can't go out and teach the kids, this is where our people harvested, these are the plants we harvested, this is where this story or legend or whatever you want to call it comes from, then we've already lost a big part of our history.
Preserving history is one of the hoped-for results for a project Taylor is working on. Way down in the southern tip of Nevada, near Searchlight, is Spirit Mountain. The Fort Mojave people call Spirit Mountain and its environs Aviquame, and it's central to their creation story. It's so sacred that Mojave Cultural Center director Linda Otero couldn't describe its meaning in detail when she talked to Nevada Public Radio in July 2020. But, she said, our origins, our beginnings, our teachings, what we need to do as people, are given to us by way of connection with the mountain. The river represents who we are, people of the river, and the mountain is part of that. It's also a choice spot for renewable energy development. Opponents have already killed one proposed wind farm in the area, and now they're fending off another. They've teamed up with the Fort Mojave and other tribes to form Honor Aviquame, a nonprofit pushing for national monument designation. The area the group seeks to protect is surrounded by federally protected lands across boundaries in adjacent states. The 380,000 acres the group is trying to protect are like the missing puzzle piece in a larger tapestry of culturally and ecologically important sites. That tapestry can pose challenges for tribes seeking U.S. government protection.
So, I'll say there's nowhere that our people were not. Our people were all over the entire what is now the state of Nevada, California. All of these places were well trekked. And I don't think any Native person gets tripped up in, well, gosh, everything's sacred to us, right? So how are we going to choose what to protect? We know there has to be consultations made. So where is the best reasonable space to do that? And so we see areas that, yes, our people were there, but that's not a point of our creation stories. That's not a point where, you know, creator is supposed to be. There's still spaces that can reasonably be given up. And it's interesting to even talk about being reasonable when giving up land, because that's still not even our land to give up. If the federal government wants to do something with a piece of land, they can reasonably do whatever they want with that. And tribal folks can say, oh, that's our ancestral land, that's where our creator is, but we have no power against them unless it's literally on the reservation.
She wishes it weren't always a fight for natives to get what they want.
I personally would love if we could just go ahead and get the land back and we let the tribes decide what to do with those areas. That would be, of course, like the best case scenario, right? If we could get back what we lost. But in these spaces, like take Aviquame, for instance, Fort Mojave feels as they're the traditional stewards of that land, and that's in their creation stories, and that's in all of their stories that have been passed down. But that's not just their land. That's the Chimoweve Paiute were there, the Hopi were there, the Navajo were there. There was a lot of people that were using that land as well, and they were part of that space. And so I think it's not just the question of would the federal government ever give back a piece of land? Sure. But how do we determine realistically who that land should go to? And I think when a lot of Native folks are talking about land back, it's so much larger than that idea. That goes back to the colonial kind of mindset, right? Of, well, then you just can own the land. And it's like, well, then you're just doing a reverse thing, and then we're ending up in sort of, not to be too political at the moment, but an Israel-Palestine situation too, right? Of, well, my ancestors were there, and my ancestors were there, and this is our land, and this is our land, and you get into this really awful space of, oh, well, whose land does that legally belong to? Nobody, right? That's everybody's land. And so I think it land back at its heart goes broader, and it goes to this idea of cooperation. And are you letting Native tribes and Native people lead in those spaces?
Taylor pointed out one reason tribes might seek that protection: the relentlessness of developers.
Developers, they find a spot that they want and they will hang around forever. And it's like if they get their application rejected for a particular area for wind or solar mining or whatever, they almost can wait out a tribal government or BLM or whoever is sort of opposing that project.
But what if this paradigm were turned on its head? What if, rather than petitioning the government to bar developers from sensitive sites, Native activists occupied those sites and waited out the developers?
What about they open up 8,000 of these lithium mines? How much water is going to be left in the state of Nevada? Southern Nevada Water Authority is looking for water. Tamawa, Reno's looking for water. And here we're destroying water for greed.
But then at the same time, you know, she used to tell me, you know, never settle for anything. Because if you settle for the money part, and then that's going to be it. Once you let go of your Mother Earth, and you know, where are you going to sit, or where are you going to stand, or where are you going to walk? Because this money's not going to last forever.
Hello, everybody. My name is Duranda Hinkey. I am a Fort McDermitt Paiute Shoshone tribal member. I am 23 years old. I currently reside in Fort McDermitt, Nevada, and I recently just graduated from Southern Oregon University with an environmental science and policy degree, and I'm really happy to be here.
Duranda is part of the People of Red Mountain.
People of Red Mountain, or Itzakudakwa Winuwa, is a group of people in the tribe, a combination of elders, middle-aged youth, who are standing up against this Thacker Pass lithium mine, as well as other mines being proposed in our area. We have a gold mine being looked at, as well as another lithium mine closer to our reservation. And we hope to stand up for our indigenous rights and for our ancestral lands, protecting Mother Earth and protecting, you know, who we are and our beliefs.
Lithium Nevada, a subsidiary of Lithium Americas, plans to build a 400-foot-deep open-pit mine in Thacker Pass, an area around 25 miles south of the Nevada-Oregon border and 50 miles southwest of the Fort McDermitt Reservation. The mine would occupy 18,000 acres of public land, managed by the BLM. At full operation, it would consume 1.7 billion gallons of water a year, enough to flood 5,000 football fields with a foot of water. Lithium Nevada believes the mine can reach an annual output of 66,000 metric tons of lithium. That will require 5,800 tons of sulfuric acid. Trucks carrying sulfuric acid ingredients will make up to 200 trips to and from the mine daily. All this is needed, proponents say, to increase production of lithium-ion batteries for powering electric vehicles and storing electricity from solar generation. Climate change activists and President Joe Biden argue domestic lithium production is key to getting the U.S. off fossil fuels and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But the mine has problems. For starters, a local cattle rancher and a group of conservationists have filed two separate lawsuits alleging that the environmental assessment used to justify the project was deeply flawed. They say the mine would have a serious detrimental effect on groundwater, streams, and sensitive wildlife, including the greater sage grouse and threatened Lahontan cutthroat trout. Indeed, the project's own environmental impact statement says a toxic plume of backwash could extend 1 mile downstream from the mine for as many as 300 years. Duranda and others are worried about the air and water pollution. She says People of Red Mountain is considering filing a lawsuit of its own.
And then on top of that, we see a more social aspect of that this lithium mine is going to be really big. It's going to have a bunch of workers. That means there's going to be a lot of people here. And are there going to be man camps? Where are these people going to stay? Where are they going to live? Are they from out of state? Are they local people? And if they are out of state, we've seen that time and time again that man camps bring in sex trafficking, sexual assault, missing persons, rape, hard alcohol, drugs. And we really don't need that in community.
Thacker Pass also holds profound significance, similar to that of the Shoshone Cedars, not just to the Fort McDermitt tribe, but other tribes as well.
Okay, so this proposed lithium mine, it sits on what is now called Thacker Pass, but in our language, it is called Pimaha, meaning rotten moon. But before that story, this place was used as a traveling route, like when we would go down into Summit Lake and back and through here. So we've used this place, and it was a campground, it was hunting grounds, and the massacre that happened there is why we call it Pimaha. The people there were slaughtered, and they were left with their insides scattered on the sagebrush. And when the hunters came back from Paradise Valley, which is probably like 30 miles away, they came back to their elders, the woman and the children, left there to rot on this area. And if you look at Thacker Pass from the east side of Thacker Pass, it looks like a crescent moon. And so there's like these consistent stories behind this place. And the more elders we've gotten up there, they've actually opened up to more stories and more things that they've heard. And, you know, a plant that I've never even heard of that they decided to talk about when they were reconnected with this land.
In addition to the traditional connection, Duranda says, there's a contemporary one too. She and her relatives hunt for deer in Thacker Pass, fish its creeks, and gather ceremonial plants. In January, not long after the BLM approved Lithium Nevada's proposal, a coalition of environmentalists, indigenous peoples, and other activists started Protect Thacker Pass, a camp on the site of the proposed mine. Participants describe it as an occupation modeled on the Dakota Access Pipeline protest led by the Standing Rock Sioux. People of Red Mountain is also raising awareness through Native-centered activities, such as horseback rides in Thacker Pass. One of the many complaints protesters have about the project is that the Trump administration fast-tracked its approval. While similar projects can take 3 to 4 years to go through application, scientific review, and public vetting, Thacker Pass was a done deal in less than a year. Part of that rush job was getting the sign-off of the Fort McDermitt Paiute and Shoshone tribe. Lithium Nevada reassured the tribal council with promises of high-paying jobs, environmental restoration, educational funding, and other assistance.
Yeah, so McDermott's input is a little iffy. Actually, the comment period was from like June to September, and it was not in person because of COVID. And during that time, actually, the whole reservation was under a lockdown because there was a really big COVID outbreak. The tribal office was closed. So there's just some weird things that went on. A lot of people weren't able to comment in that public comment period of the EIS. And so now we kind of got left with like the pickup pieces.
In the months that followed the project's approval, the media and activists spread news of its potential harm. In April, the tribe reversed its endorsement.
A lot of younger people and a lot of elders, they're really pushing against this. Like, let's absolutely stop it. Let's not have our people uprooted from their grave. Let's just keep them there. This is a very special, powerful place. And we see that time and time again. And so you do see both sides, but I've always been taught to, you know, sit down and listen to our elders, sit down and listen to what they say. And what they're telling me is that they feel in their heart that we should be stopping this mine. We should be opposing it. We should be standing up and fighting against it.
Another lesson they've taught her: money is temporary, but her connection to the land is forever.
I actually had an elder tell me that his grandma always told him that the white people are always going to come for the land and the water. They're going to ask you to sell it off. They're going to provide all this money for you, but don't do it. Our biggest connection and our culture is connected, deeply connected to the land. If you're selling the land and the water, then you're selling our culture. That's just what it comes down to.
So, what is the end game for Protect Thacker Pass and the people of Red Mountains activism?
I understand that this is public land, but I really hope to see that the indigenous communities are protected, you know, public land. Once it was indigenous land, and I'm hoping that it is maybe a like preservation area, you know, keeping this land as it is. And we've seen that with the Sheldon Antelope Refuge, wildlife refuge. It's actually in Nevada, and they saved that place for the antelope. And I'm hoping to see that, you know, this whole McDermott caldera is saved.
In other words, Natives' fight to reassert themselves in the landscapes isn't over. Here's Taylor Patterson again.
And we've had everything taken from us and so much more. You know, like I had a conversation recently with one of the folks down at the Cultural Center at Fort Mojave. And she was telling me, you know, we've got transistor lines going through our ancestral lands. We've got pipelines. We've got a highway. Like, at what point have we given enough to this country? And that point never seems to come. When it comes to oil pipelines or gold mines, lithium mines, like is going up in Thacker Pass, we have never been given the respect of, oh, wow, you say no? That's fine.
As for the Shoshone Cedars, the bill to protect them from being cut down passed both houses of the Nevada legislature, despite opposition from state agencies and most Republican representatives. Governor Steve Sisolak signed it into law in March. But for Delaine Spilsbury, the state law is not enough. She wants permanent protection for the natural memorial to her slain ancestors. If that has to come through the federal government, then so be it.
Well, Heidi, I'm going to have to tell you about an old boyfriend of mine. He was better than nothing. And that's kind of how I feel about protecting, but we have to do something so we won't have a conscience beating on us.
And by the way, we invited U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland to talk with us about the federal protection of indigenous lands. We told her we were looking at the Shoshone Cedars, Avi Kwame, and Thacker Pass. Her office declined. Still, as an enrolled member of the Laguna Pueblo, her very presence in the department is meaningful.
I love having the representation in the interior, and I think we almost get too caught up in what a win that was, because it is so important, yes, but the fact that it took this long is wrong, and the fact that we don't have land acknowledgement in one form or another in these federal pieces of land in these national parks is such a piece of erasure. And it's so unfortunate because everybody is searching for the true American story, and it's right there.
You've been listening to Native Nevada, KNPR's podcast about the indigenous peoples of the region now known as the U.S. state of Nevada. This production is made possible by a grant from the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. Producers are Heidi Kaiser and Joe Shaneman. Assistant producers are Jarrett Work and Avery Wyatt. Sound design is by Regina Revazova of Open Conversation. You can find more episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm your host, Richard Boland. Thanks for listening.